You are listening to Faithless Brewer, a Magic the Gathering podcast for the Spike Room. Each week, we design new decks for tournament play. We put our creations to the test and share our findings on the air. Coming up on the roundup, the spiciest new technology from the Modern Challenge, plus a look at the metagame and Pioneer. Then on the flashback, testing results with Magmatic Channeler and the return of Is It Phoenix. Finally, on the brew session, new decks with Luminarch Aspirin. All of that and more is coming up on this edition of Faithless Brewing. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
Welcome to episode 76 of the Faithless Brewing Podcast. I am David Robertson, joining you from Minneapolis, and I am joined by my guy on the left coast, Damon Alexander. Damon, what's popping?
Hey. Well, not Omnathan Standard, at least, but otherwise life is good.
It was popping too hard. We are, of course, joined by the CEO of the Faithless Brewing Podcast. He is Dan Schriever. Daniel San, what's going on?
Hey guys, how you doing? Hello from North Carolina. Damon, I gotta disagree with that assessment. I watched the season grand finals this weekend. I felt like my entire Sunday was just watching Omnath going off against other Omnath decks.
Yeah, those games were just absurd. You could never tell who was ahead because somebody would be like, I'm going to have 20 lands and play 20 creatures, your turn. And then by the end of that, the other person would be like, wipe your board. Now I have 20 lands and 20 creatures and an Ugin. And then they wound up losing.
I think at some point the commentary team, maybe it was Riley Knight, was often likening the games to like, oh, this is reminds me of how commander games work. You know, whoever's turn it is just like going off and making all these insane plays on their turn. And then it's like, oh, they can't lose. And then the next player takes their turn. Then they start going off and they build up an insane board and wipe the opponent's board. And I almost like was waiting for someone to like, you know, tap Riley Knight's shoulder and be like, you know, stop giving away the secrets.
Yeah, exactly. I said the quiet part loud and the loud part quiet. So
commander in all formats. So what did you think of the event? Apart from all that,
I think that the top eight with like the double elimination is just really long to watch. I never really understand like where we even are in the lower bracket. And so I just sort of like tune out during that whole stretch.
That's an interesting point. I also like dislike the double elimination brackets. It just seems like really, really arbitrarily unfair for like a paper boomer like myself, who's just so used to Swiss Magic followed by a clean top eight. Just the fact that, you know, if you win in the upper bracket, it's worth the equivalent of like, I don't know how many wins in the lower bracket. This is so arbitrary. The order in which your wins and losses come will dictate not just like your final standing, but also how many matches you have to play.
Well, that's true in a normal top eight. I mean, if you, you know, win-win, lose versus lose, win-win.
Yeah. So you're saying that if we want the joys of double elimination, there's just no way around this.
Yeah. I mean, I don't think this like it's worth it. I get that it's perhaps more fair, but what is the goal of the tournament? Is to have a good time and have a good show for viewers and crown a reasonable champion. Whether you do like, you know, if you want to find the best player in the room, you could do 10,000 iterations of a tournament, whoever wins the most times. And that'd be like a super stable result, but also kind of, you know, not fun.
Well, you could run the tournament simultaneously in like a million parallel universes and then just survey to see who won the most often across all realities. Crown Seth Manfield the champion once again.
Yeah, in three of those universes, Omnath is still around.
Oh, gosh. Well, back to our darkest timeline. Today is Tuesday, October 13th, although by the time you're hearing this, it will probably be even later in the month. So this is our weekly check-in. To go, if you live in the U.S., go and register to vote, go and cast your vote. Early voting in person is opening up in my state, in North Carolina, this week. David, I know you already have cast your votes already in the great state of Minnesota.
Well, I have not cast my vote because I am an election judge. I'm going to vote in person at the place that I am judging at, out of solidarity with my fellow citizens. Put on the mask and, you know, wipe myself down and everything and vote first thing in the morning.
Yeah, I think, I mean, early returns are suggesting that there's a lot of enthusiasm for voting early in person. I think I saw some really long lines in Georgia. I mean, the reason to go early, as you can, is because we don't want to have these long lines on election day itself. You know, you're talking about potentially very long waits. You should be spaced out 6 feet apart. There's lots and lots of reasons to look into this now. We've harped on a little bit the last few weeks, so I'm just saying it again.
Yeah, and you know, even just for your own personal safety, you know, voting when there's less people around, just to be done with it. You don't have to have any more debates with uncles or siblings or whatever. It's like, you know, the vote's cast and just get ready for the peaceful transition of power in January 19th of 2021.
Is that a good way to like resolve an argument with your uncle? Is be like, well, I already voted.
Well, I mean, at a certain point, there's nothing more to debate, right? Like if they voted and you voted, now you're just waiting to see what the tabulations are.
Yes, because normally people debate in a fair way that leads to a lot of people changing their minds over time as they consider reasonable arguments. Is that your theory, David?
The internet has done nothing but show that reasonable discourse will carry the day. Nobody will resort to ad hominem attack or exaggerating their opponent's positions, or they'll argue in good faith. So, yeah, I think that's right.
What a time to be alive. Well, speaking of the internet, things you can do on the internet include stopping by our Patreon and our new website, faithlessbrewing.com. So we have a little bit of podcast housekeeping. We'll try to keep it brief.
Yeah, so our newest, or I guess this is an increased pledge from Kilgore Trout 503. Thank you very much for the increase. Kilgore Trout, very active in the Discord. As people on the Discord know, always coming up with cool ideas, tweaks to existing decks, etc. Or, you know, sometimes just having to complain when the format is not what we want it to be. So if you just want to commiserate in some frustrations, Kilgore Trout is on there to do that as well.
Yeah, Kilgore Trout is a fantastic brewer, especially of like Indomitable Creativity, Luca, Iron Craig Feet type combo decks. But where he's really amazing is in coming up with punny names for all of his decks. Sometimes we'll see like two or three iterations of the name of the deck over the course of like a brewer's lifetime in the Discord. I suspect that he's like comes up with a name first and then tries to like reverse engineer a deck from the name. So big shout outs to Kilgore. And if anyone listening wants to support our work on the podcast, you can do so at patreon.com/faithisbrewing. That's where you can become a supporting member. As little as a dollar a show, even something as small as that goes a long way in helping us keep the lights on, pay for our editing, pay for our hosting fees, that kind of thing. There are also some cool perks and rewards that you will get. We've talked about our Discord channel. You can come join and chat with us there. If you go up to the higher tiers, we have even some merchandise. I'm holding in my hands right now our very first batch of custom tokens. I got a whole stack of Daemon tokens. Fanning these out right now. Daemon
just
tokens.
Holding physical cards again is nice.
This is like the first physical cards I've held since I can't even remember when. They're all in a closet somewhere. I haven't tried spell table yet. Got a bunch of myself here as a monastery mentor and David as the young pyromancer. So these are really sweet looking cards. You can get those at the Brewer Virtuoso tier. And if you would like to get your hands on our sick looking playmats, that is available on the Patreon as well.
Finally, I have something to come out of this podcast to show my mom.
Exactly. I can get these to you in time for Mother's Day as well. So more on from the website. David, tell us about a little bit of these deck lists that you've been cooking up for faithlessbrewing.com.
Yeah, so the one that's posted already is a blue-black ninja rogues list. So I am known to have a weakness for ninjas. Ninja the Deep Hours, unfortunately, basically just printed a strictly better version. So we basically don't ever get to play it again, which is single tier. Try and take advantage of the fact that Thieves Guild Enforcer kind of has a come into play ability. So, you know, if you play that turn one flash, then you attack with Ingenious Infiltrator. You get to play your Thieves Guild Enforcer later in the game. And Changeling Outcast now has almost a Lord effect. So with both Ingenious Infiltrator, it's a ninja, so you get to draw an extra card. Soaring Thought Thief buffs its power. So, you know, sometimes it had been used as a fairy. I think the way that the mana decks have succeeded, you basically just like Spellstar Sprite, although it's a card that I love, I just don't think it's that good anymore. But Drown in the Lock with all of these mill effects becomes actually the counterspell that you want, I think. The speculative card here is Jace's Phantasm. Getting to 7 cards is very possible. I don't know about getting to 10, but just a 1-drop is reasonable in a world where you're just trying to ninja it. And the rest of it is just all kind of reactive spells. Fatal Push, Thought Scour, Force of Negation, etc.
Yeah, it looks sweet. I would like wonder about Spectral Sailor as the 1-drop of choice, just because that card is good in certain matchups in a way that's pretty different. Maybe you want something that's good against burn.
I think you're right, probably, that Jace's Phantasm will be end up being worse than that. But I think starting with Jace's Phantasm is like the highest possible card, where all of a sudden, you know, you're just attacking for five on turn four or something, is where I'd start. Just because I think it's a card that has seen no play. We've liked it at various points in certain mill shells. And by we, I think maybe just you. But yeah, I agree. The kind of card I would prefer to play is Spectral Sailor, and I suspect that probably would end up being the best card, or a better card than Jace's Phantasm.
And the sweet thing is, I mean, I saw Zarathan run up against, I forget who was streaming, but they just got absolutely housed by Zarathan, like steal your Omnath or whatever, and then steal your Teferi Time Rattler.
Oh gosh. So Xerath gets any permanent, right?
Yeah.
Not just creatures?
Yeah.
And with the amount of, you know, mill you have between Soaring Thought Thief, I'm going to have a hard time saying that for the next 3 months, Thieves Guild Enforcer and Thought Scour, you can all of a sudden just, you know, hit a Primeval Titan or, you know, 5-mana Teferi. I mean, you can just get very fortunate. And it allows a lot more selection than Fallen Shinobi. I've had the experience where Fallen Shinobi reveals two cards that are very, like, synergy-driven. A lot of cards in Modern, at least at that time, we're much more focused on the deck specifically. You know, if you hit Valakid in your blue-black deck, right, that just isn't that good. But being able to look at their entire graveyard, especially when you have all these effects that are putting two, you know, three cards in there at a time, means you can really just, you know, you're getting a lot more than 4 mana for your effect.
I had a chance to play against a Rogues deck this week while I was testing out Magmatic Channeler from last week. So I'll save my thoughts until the flashback segment. But I'll just say that I like David's list quite a lot more than what I was seeing from this other Modern's Rogues list in the queues. But it has some interesting tech. I mean, it turns out that if you're just looking for sneaky looking evasive creatures, most Rogues fall into that category. So there's even like that 1/2 unblockable Naga thing, Slither Blade. If you're concerned about your creatures dying, obviously that never hits for more than one, but it can never be blocked. It is a Rogue, but maybe it's not high enough upside. Maybe we just want the Phantasm. So anyway, go check out, there will be a link in the show notes here, but yeah, go check faithexperience.com for more lists like this. We have another Mardu kind of Magmatic Channeler list that David came up with after we talked about it last week's episode. So this is one that we didn't get a chance to test out, but he's got a sort of nice write-up coming there if you want a little more extra tech. Another article more in the sort of feature article category is that I've been playing a lot of Pioneer this week, which we'll get into, and I'm in the process of writing up a longer deck guide on Is It Phoenix, of all things. So if you're looking for more content on that, definitely stop by our website, and we'll be adding more to it all the time.
Excellent. So the state of the world, we won't dig too deep into the Standard announcement, although we are aware of the bannings. Standard is not really our purview. I think we've spoken kind of at length about the weaknesses of Fire Design and sort of the frustration with how WotC has decided to allocate its resources as they relate to Design and Standard. This is of a piece with sort of the last couple years. And I suspect that the next few sets, because they have already been decided, will also have multiple cards that will also need banning. So I do feel bad for Standard players. I do feel bad for all the excellent players that showed up in the tournament this weekend. Interest is really low considering the stakes, and the players were very excellent, and they played at a very high level. And so I think the game just needs to meet the the level that the players are setting it, and I think we'd be in a good place.
On the subject of the BNR, we have touched on Historic in the past, so Omnath was banned in Standard, was also suspended in Historic. So that did make me wonder if we should be expecting something like this coming for Pioneer and Modern.
Well, I mean, we just haven't seen the results that back that up. I mean, you know, you had 70% of the format or whatever in Standard was Omnath. I don't remember the number. And you look at the most played decks in Modern, and you look at the most played decks in Pioneer, and you just don't see that many Omnaths. And then you look at the top eights, and, you know, depending on the top eight, you might see a few, and depending on the top eight, you might not see any. Modern especially, we've talked about this the last few weeks, has just been really impressive in its ability to rotate and bend. You know, playing these really powerful fair cards is something that Modern can adapt to. It's really powerful unfair cards that have been the issue for Modern in the past.
Sometimes it takes the control decks longer to figure out a new meta, and Omnath slots into those control decks. So we'll see if people really figure out what's going on with these Omnath Uro decks. Leading into this, we should mention that Canister won the Sunday Challenge on a Saheeli Felidar Guardian version of Omnath Uro Pile.
True. So let's do a brief check-in on what we're seeing for Modern. So these days, there are two challenges per weekend, one Saturday, one Sunday. So we are getting a fair amount of data from high-level Modern play on Magic Online. Sometimes there will also be additional tournaments like PTQs or whatever they're called now, and also preliminaries. So we're getting a fairly solid picture of like what's winning. And just looking at these two tournaments from this past weekend, I mean, the format looks great, I would say. The Saturday Challenge has one of the most diverse and fair top eights you could possibly even dream up. I think it was won by Death and Taxes, a deck we talked about last week. What else happened? Rakdos Shadow was in third, Burn in fourth, Jund, Classic Jund in second, Humans, Sultai Control, Blue Tron, and Banned Spirits. That's your top eight.
Yeah, and then your top 16 has just a bunch of like actual almost like borderline homebrews. You have Boros Land Hate from Ice Nine. You have the green-white Selesnya Titan, kind of a variant of what F. Paul's has been playing and we've mentioned. So, yeah, I mean, if you just looked at that one particular result, the format just looks exactly what you'd want it to be. Just super cool, a bunch of crazy synergies taking place. No individual card dominating. Even the one like Oops All Spells list in the top 16 is like a reasonable amount for a deck like that to show up.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, the Saturday Challenge looks like the kind of Magic that we and I think a lot of players love to play. That's Saturday. The Sunday Challenge, slightly different results. So Damon mentioned that Canister took first place with Felidar Saheeli. That has sort of become a four-color value deck where you're just trying to blink targets like Teferi, Time Raveler, and Oath of Nissa with your Felidar Guardians until you're ready to combo off. Well, it turns out that Omnath just already is in the right colors and does everything that you would want out of a card. You know, it provides a card if you want to blink the Omnath, if you just want to blink a land to get your second landfall trigger or your third landfall trigger. It works with Felidar that way. And it just like gives you explosive amounts of mana if you are trying to have like your combo turn. And it gains a bunch of life and draws a card and just on top of all that. So that's the rundown on the deck. That was not the only Omnath deck. There were a bunch of other Omnath decks in this Sunday challenge.
Well, I mean, these 4C control lists play two Omnath, so I'm a little uncomfortable calling that an Omnath deck. It is a deck that has Omnath, but I mean, we're only talking about 10 total copies in a top eight. I just don't think that that's too that crazy.
True, true. So do you think that Omnath is a control card?
Yeah, I mean, it wants the game to go late. I mean, it stalls the game out with the four life. It grinds with drawing a card. You want to have bigger spells to utilize the burst of mana it has. You generally want to have, you know, maybe like a Renin 6 around to get reliable landfall triggers. So all the thing that it kind of does is it doesn't really seem like a top-end card.
Yeah, I mean, the list that plays four of them is Canister's list, and that is not a control deck. That's a combo deck, right? He called it Splinter Twin. And so it's sort of your fallback plan. When you don't get to do your win thing, it does a bunch of other stuff. It stabilizes your life total, and it draws cards and possibly threatens other planeswalkers. I think the control lists are just would play any sort of value creature in that slot. They haven't seemed like more or less powerful since Omnath was added. And I wouldn't be surprised, you know, when if the right call is to actually just play three colors with Uro and Omnath is almost like a fool's gold kind of a thing. I do see these lists lose to their mana a lot. I think getting Uro back is actually often better than being able to play Omnath versus some of the other threats. I noticed in the other challenge, a Sultai control list top aided. And if I was forced to play an Uro pile to with a gun to my head to get the best finish, I would try a three color list before I played a four color Omnath list. But that's just me. I hate like you're playing all these colorless lands in your four color deck. I just want my mana base to be smooth and creamy, consistent. I want to have much better opening hands against people who are just trying to like cheese me out with Blood Moon or playing all kinds of other stuff. So
yeah, that's a fair point. It reminds me of like on the first weekend of Zendikar Rising, McWinsauce was one of the first sort of prominent players to be having success with these four color Uro pile, Money Tribal or whatever it's called these days. And there were like back-to-back tournaments where he had his list published. One of them had like three Omnaths and the other one, he just like cut an Omnath for Wall of Blossoms. I was like, what is that all about? It's like, well, these do, you know, roughly equivalent things, you know, given the needs of the deck. You know, maybe sometimes you want a Wall of Blossom, sometimes you want an Omnath. And I'm like, oh, okay. Which sounds just kind of, it just sounds silly after seeing Omnath just wreak utter destruction on the lower power standard and historic formats.
I wish we could get like a breakdown of the full, like who shows up on in the Swiss. Because one thing I'm noticing in the second modern challenge is that there's basically no decks that are attacking your mana at all. I think those decks do have good Omnath matchups, or whatever you want to call them, Omnath Uro pile matchups. I mean, they really do just tax them in a very effective way, and you just don't see them showing up at all. So yeah, when you're in the mirror, then you want to be a little bigger because that probably helps you. But there's basically no aggro at all. And so in that case, I think it turns into an arms race. Like 4C Saheeli probably is really good against 4C control.
Yeah, I mean, the fact that the top three decks in Modern right now seem to be the sort of four-color Omneth piles, red-black shadow, and then mono-white taxes. And the mono-white taxes and red-black shadow list both attack Tron-type decks very effectively. And I think also, like, the Ponza deck has a bad mono-white matchup, you know, trying to play Utopia Sprawl against a deck playing Ghost Quarter type situation. So I think it's kind of like a distorting effect on the meta overall that we'll see how this, you know, takes shape over the next month.
And I mean, Gruul is just gone. I mean, that used to be, in my opinion, a tier one deck. I don't know which specific decks it matches up poorly with now, but it is just not visible at all.
Yeah. The Shadow deck also just gets much bigger than Gruul is good at answering.
Yeah. And it can operate with two lands. I mean, it doesn't. And Blood Moon obviously isn't as good against a deck that only needs black, one black yeah. to function.
So yeah. It's like, if your deck has a bad matchup against two of those top three decks, I feel like you're going to want to rethink what you take to the challenge.
But the format is still super wide. I mean...
Yeah.
Like, we're talking about the top deck is, what, 5% of the meta?
Well, collectively, all the Uro piles are probably a little more than that, but they all even play out differently. Cancer's List is different than 4C Control. 4C Control is different than Sultai Uro. They have different strengths and weaknesses. They have different cards in terms of, like, their answer. So the creature choice you make actually does matter. You have to – different sideboard cards are good against them.
Yeah.
So a couple lists I want to ask you guys about. We talked about the Faladar Saheeli already, but there's another deck from the Sunday Challenge that took fourth place. This is the green-white Heliod Infinite Life Counters deck, highlighted by Coert. And, you know, I was like, man, I keep seeing this one player's name. I clicked on their results just to see like how well they've been doing. They have been absolutely crushing Modern with this green-white deck. I mean, they won a challenge 2 weeks ago, but they're all over the challenge top eights, top 32s, 4-1 prelims, 5-0 leagues. This is not a deck that people really talk about. So what do you guys think? Is this like secretly the best deck in Modern?
I've played against it twice and I won both times. And the deck seemed a little weak in some ways in the sense that they play Conclave Mentor, and you're like, okay, well, they actually don't have that many creatures to give counters. It's not like the Hardened Scales list of yore where every other card, you know, Walking Ballista, the Arcbound Ravager, et cetera, just like an endless stream of creatures with counters on them. This deck plays a bunch that don't. And so it's really the scary part from it is the Heliod lines with both Spike Feeder and Walking Ballista, which can give it a win out of nowhere. And so it has a bunch of really powerful plays, but it also feels like it just can fall apart against decks like Jund. So I'm surprised that it seems to be so popular and doing so well.
Yeah, I think one of the things that happened is, you know, Infinite Life doesn't beat every deck in Modern, but it beats all the decks that we're seeing here with almost without exception. So I think when you can just Coco into your win, you know, maybe you're just getting a lot of points that way.
Yeah. Yeah, it's true that the deck does set up the combo quite easily, and decks like Jund actually do have problems against cards like Heliod, where you can Thoughtseize it in the early turns, but once it comes down, they have really no way to get it off the battlefield.
And I'm just thinking even like Death and Taxes loses to Infinite Life, Oops All Spells loses to Infinite Life, and they don't interact with it that well either. You know, if you're relying on your Skyclave Apparition or whatever, it's just often just too late.
Yeah, although that is a card that does cleanly answer Heliod.
True.
What is the function of the Conclave Mentors in this list?
It gives you infinite power when you do your Spike Feeder Heliod combo, and it puts it on multiple creatures if you like. So every time you iterate, you remove a +1/+1 counter from Spike Feeder to gain 2 life. Heliod triggers, you put a +1/+1 counter back on Spike Feeder. If you have Conclave Mentor in play, you put 2 +1/+1 counters on it. So you iterate that as much as you like, you gain infinite life, and then you get infinite +1/+1 counters on your Spike Feeder. And then you can remove all those to gain life and put those +1/+1 counters on anything else. So it's also like a haste way to put infinite counters on multiple attackers if you have those, etc.
Yeah, you basically alternate where Heliod places counters with every other one going to Spike Feeder.
So is that just a concession to needing to end the game before your timer runs out? It's not actually required for your combo.
Well, it's required to... Basically, the ideal combo involves a Walking Ballista because it wins on the spot. Infinite life is a lot worse than infinite damage. But Conclave Mentor gives you infinite damage at the same time as you get infinite life just in this creature combat role where you have every creature you have becomes infinite. So it's like a Vraska ultimate, I guess. But your creatures don't die to Bolt.
Interesting. Well, the results seem to be, you know, they speak for themselves, at least for the pilot cohort. So shout outs to them. They've been doing a great job with this list.
One thing I do want to highlight is this list is playing for Utopia Sprawl. This is a card we've been talking about for like 10 months. I don't know how long. 11 months, a year. Canister's list is now playing for Utopia Sprawl. So that was technology that was taken from the Niv players. It's added to the 4C Saheeli combo. It's in this list. Utopia Sprawl is just a super powerful card. Obviously played in the red-green Ponza. Resistant to all the removal in red-black. It's just a great, great card. And I think it's a big part of the success of this deck. You can Utopia Sprawl turn one, turn two, play your Conclave Mentor. Turn three, you can Coco into your combo, gain infinite life, do infinite damage.
Yeah, every format I play, I'm always impressed at just how good of a play it is when you go turn one mana dork. Feels like it's one of the most busted things you can do in Magic.
Yeah, and Utopia Sprawl fixing for whatever color you need and being immune to Bolt, Path, Lightning Bolt, etc. is just really, really spectacular.
Absolutely. Couple more decks to shout out. So Goblin Charbolter made a return appearance in the Sunday Challenge in the hands of the pilot Wyvern. This is a deck built around the double-faced spell lands from Zendikar Rising. We talked about this right off the bat because it was kind of like, oh no, is the format broken again? Like, have we done it again? Well, it turns out you can hate out that deck pretty well. Then we saw a switch to Undercity Informer, Balustrade Spy, Vengevine lists with like the Sword of the Meek, Salvage Titan shenanigans to do that. And then that got hated out. Belcher came back, this time with another round of tech. So what Wyvern was playing was the Charbelcher, so it's got a lot of Simian Spirit Guide and Red Ritual effects. But in addition to the combo kill, there's four Chalice of the Void and four Blood Moons in the main deck. So it's kind of like this cheesy prison angle is like thrown in large quantities to the main deck. And then you eventually win with the Charbelcher combo.
Yeah, I actually love this. I mean, I hate that this deck exists, but if you must play this deck, it kind of reminds me of the version that was like mono red and they would try to, you know, kind of soft lock you with Chalice and Blood Moon. But their way to win was to play like Goblin Rabble Master or something and just like hope to get there. And what happened was it wouldn't get there. You just draw a Bolt in Time or whatever, and you'd eventually get out of it. This deck is like, all right, I'm just need to buy a couple of turns because I have an ironclad lock to actually win the game as soon as I can assemble like just a couple of cards. So I like that. You can get your nut draws where you Charbelcher early. You can get your nut draws where you Chalice or Blood Moon people when that is relevant. I think Blood Moon is just a great card right now. We just talked about all these Uro piles, and Mountains don't cast that many Uros or Omnaths.
Yeah, I mean, at the point that you're playing a lot of the same cards as Mono Red Prison, why don't you just call your Chandras and add Goblin Charbelcher?
Yeah, exactly.
There's a nice innovation that's been made in the last few weeks to this deck, and that's the sideboard package where you can go recross the paths. You put on top Collected Company, Thassa's Oracle, Undercity Informer, and then the next turn you draw your Coco, and you Coco into Oracle under Former, and with Thassa's Oracle in the stack, you sack one of the creatures and mill out your deck. So nice, clean, Magic win. Everybody has fun when you do that, right?
Smiles and handshakes all around. Congratulates you as we felt the match slip. All right, so that's the latest Charbelcher tech. Going into the more roguish strategy, so we talked about Cleansing Wildfire 2 weeks ago, and I think you heard us talk about on last week's episode how I really enjoyed the deck in like a red-white, David, you called it Boom-Bust Cleanse, kind of land destruction, but utilizing Boom-Bust in conjunction with Flagstones of Trocaire, Darkseer Citadel, that kind of thing. That red-white style is often associated with a player who goes by the name Ice9, because they've been playing this for forever, and they have their own Discord channel and that sort of thing, just for red-white enthusiasts. So this deck, at least in the hands of Ice9, is still plugging away. But I thought it was interesting that, you know, seeing the list that they made top 16 with in the Saturday Challenge, some of the choices on the top-end cards, the lack of Cleansing Wildfire, I mean, it has all the lands, it just doesn't have the Wildfire. And there's an enchantment package of Suppression Field and Ghostly Prison. So what do you guys think of this, right? So for comparison, the list that I played last week had Planeswalkers, it had Nahiri and Emrakul on the top. It had some just, you know, it relied on Wrath of God type stuff for removal. And it was not playing Goblin Dark Dwellers or Magus of the Tabernacle.
Yeah, this deck is kind of like a Turbo Stasis deck where it just wants to get into one specific game state and it wants to get there very fast, and the game state has to be very clean for them. And so you can't afford to play cards like Nahiri or whatever, which are good when things go wrong, but this deck sort of just needs to have things not go that wrong.
Yeah, I mean, the one card I really like here is Valakut Awakening. You know, one of the things we were using Nahiri for was obviously as sort of a combo kill once you've kind of stalled the game, but she also let you cycle through land destruction spells when they weren't useful, or, you know, Mana Tithe when you were unlikely going to get your opponent anymore. And Valakut Awakening kind of does the same thing while also being a mana source, because this deck doesn't want to like curve out to three or four, and then it can kind of stop. I've never actually cast a Magnus of the Tabernacle. I will say that, but I don't know that I believe in this card. It looks super sweet. I actually like this whole cycle of wizards that sort of replicate cool effects from Magic's history that was in Time Shifted. I just worry sort of about your ability to close. You know, the deck just really cannot do lethal damage very easily. You just have to draw your Goblin Darkdweller, pay your one each turn for Magus, and just get in there. And if it dies, then you have to draw your second one.
Just to clarify on David's point, this deck features as win conditions two Magus the Tabernacle, a 2/6, two Goblin Darkdwellers, a 4/4. And I guess there's two Lightning Bolts.
And so, Molten Rains can do up to 4 or 8 damage. And then I guess Goblin Darkdwellers buying them back can do another 4.
Yes. This deck is extremely light on win conditions.
So, I mean, that's one of the reasons why I like the Nahiri package, is it's just a really, it's only 5 cards. Like Damon says, Nahiri actually handles stuff. It kills enchantments. You don't have to sideboard Enchantment Hate, for instance. It does kill creatures if you wanted to, and exiles them, which is relevant against Uro and a few other cards. So, I mean, I can't argue with the success here. It's awesome that Magus the Tabernacle is seeing high-level play in Modern, to your point about it being wide open, but I wouldn't feel that comfortable bringing it in. The cards that I like that we weren't playing are Valakut Awakening and Suppression Field. Those are both cards I'm kind of interested in, but Suppression Field is only interesting if you yourself are not playing Planeswalkers.
Yeah, it's almost like if you decide that Suppression Field is an important and well-positioned card, then you just can't play Nahiri, so you have to look for 4/4 minutes for 5. To cross the finish line. That's the only other option, really. Other change that I do like here is, you know, I talked about the removal options last week, and I think I was playing 4 Lightning Bolt. Lightning Bolt is only so-so against some of the threats people will come at you with. So Ice Nine is playing only 2 Bolt and 3 Oust, because obviously you don't want to play Path to Exile. You don't want to get them lands, but Oust does most of what you want.
I do just want to clarify, too, Goblin of the Dark Dwellers no longer flashes back Boom Bust. Just for people who may not be familiar, when they changed the way the rules work arbitrarily and randomly for these split cards. And they basically didn't even like change the rules. It's just like, it was always just some random hand wavy lawyerly thing. They just switched a few commas around. So it used to be you could Goblin Darkdwellers back Boom Bust and cast the bust half. Now you can't cast either half. It looks in the graveyard and sees a 8 mana spell. So
that's a good advice for anyone dusting off their Goblin Darkdwellers deck from 4 years ago or whatever it was.
Well, from your top 16 deck from this weekend, the latest Modern
absolutely deck. Absolutely. All right, last deck to ask you about. Tell me about this Enduring Ideal deck, Damon.
Yeah, so this deck is a wild one. It is built to use the card Enduring Ideal, which is 5 white for a sorcery. Search your library for an enchantment card, put into play, shuffle your library, and okay, that's cool, but it also has Epic. Epic means that for the rest of the game, you can't play spells, but every turn, at the beginning of your upkeep, you copy this spell. So basically, every turn, you get to go find an enchantment. And so the question is, well, what is that? You know, why is that a good thing to do? And the answer is, well, first off, you can set up a 9 lives Phyrexian or Phyrexian unlife combo that go with Solemnity. And so both of those involve you getting counters before you die. And so that makes you invincible. And once you're invincible, then you can take your time and find a form of the dragon, which does 5 damage every turn to a target of your choice, which will usually be your opponent. And then it has greater Auromancy, giving all your enchantments Shroud. And so it creates this kind of enchantment prison that your opponent will have trouble breaking out of unless they have some very specialized tools. So how does it get to cast Enduring Ideal? Well, it just kind of stalls with Lotus Bloom and I guess Silence and some Anthonices and, you know, like a Gideon's Intervention, I guess. And the old Leyline of Sanctity plus Nykthos Trick to get a little bit of mana ramp, potentially. So looks like a 4-2 finish by Rinko. Interesting deck. I guess Rinko must have liked their matchups against like the red-black deck. I think Dave and I were both watching Doomwake get completely crushed by this. The Shadow deck does not deal well with 9 lives plus Solemnity.
Why is Silence in the deck? I don't really understand that.
My guess is that you do it in response to like a combo deck going off, or it basically, you know, like this deck can't interact very well with something like Primeval Titan. So it's basically like you cast it in their upkeep against some of these more linear decks, and it's functionally a time walk in terms of it gives you another turn to play a land or to, you know, bring your Lotus Bloom off of Suspend. It also is a card you can play in response to Lotus Bloom coming off Suspend, so it can be sacrificed in your main phase. Because a trick that happens a lot, right, is people, you know, destroy the Lotus Bloom in your upkeep.
Interesting.
Yeah. I guess it must, this deck just really needs to buy time for the Enduring Ideal and then hope that that's enough to close out the game. And so if Silence buys you that little sliver of time, the fact that it's card disadvantage is not important.
It's like the White Veil of Summer, I guess. That's also a counterspell against.
Well, but Silence has to be done like proactively. You don't know if they have it. You don't get to stop Thoughtseize or whatever. You have to cast it.
Right.
But Storm starts to go off. They cast their first ritual or whatever, or, you know, Pass in Flames, and you just cast Silence. I mean, it's actually like better than a counterspell in that if it resolves.
I almost wonder if this deck should play like some Force of Virtues just to get Nykthos online faster. That's probably crazy.
That seems crazy.
Yeah. I think you just have to mulligan to Lotus Bloom and just believe.
Form of the Virtuous Dragon.
I mean, how does this beat Teferi? Like, they resolve Teferi. Lotus Bloom can never come into play, and they can't kill Teferi. They have one cast out.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's why you need the Force of Virtues to get your Nykthos online.
Yeah, I mean, also the Teferi decks aren't that fast, and I guess if you have Enduring Ideal, Teferi doesn't actually shut down the epic ability.
Yeah, that's true. All right, so that is Modern in a nutshell. As you can tell, it's all over the place. These are really cool lists, and this is just like the tip of the iceberg. There's so many cool decks in Modern. Been loving Modern. I do want to take just a couple minutes to just check in on Pioneer, because we've been, you know, not talking about it as much in our roundup segments the last few weeks. I played a bunch of Pioneer this week, and David, I think you did too. So what's your sense of the metagame?
I think if you just look at the straight numbers, you see a lot of the same decks are still good, which is engine decks and then basically aggro decks that can play Thoughtseize. By engine decks, I do mean Fires of Invention. So typically that's a Jeskai Luka, a Niv-Mizzet as like the ultimate engine to just draw a bunch more removal spells. And then the Lotus combo. And often these decks pair with Urien in some capacity or another. And then your aggro deck that plays Thoughtseize is Mono Black. And it did get a few new toys. That new 3-1 is actually quite good. I think it's better than Scrap Heap Scrounger. And then you have your like faux combo aggro deck, which is Orzhov Auras.
Yeah, and I wouldn't even count that as a Thoughtseize deck, really.
But it can Thoughtseize.
It can.
After board.
True. The black aggro deck is like, doesn't even feel like aggro, really. It feels more like a Delver deck. Cheap threats and a little bit of disruption. But like aggro, like where is the red deck? Right? There's nowhere in the top 10. There's a great sort of metagame report that's on the Pioneer subreddit from a user ACC956. And, you know, the top 8 or 9 archetypes, black aggro is the number one deck, if we're calling it black aggro. But the next most popular is Niv-Mizzet, the four-color Omnath of various stripes, whether that's ramp or whether that's just like the port of the standard decks. Jeskai Luka Lotus combo, which has the new Peer into the Abyss tech. And Esper Control, Religious Reclamation. I mean, these are decks that go really, really big. When they're doing their things, they're just like going really big. So I feel like the small ball decks, the creature-based decks, are really getting squeezed right now in the Pioneer metagame.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think it's the artifact of what we're seeing in Standard. They just don't print good cards for that. You know, we're talking about the best 3-mana card ever. It's a, you know, or whatever. One of the best 3-mana threats ever. It's played in all the way back to Legacy, Uro, and Omnath, it's played all the way into Modern, and Niv-Mizzet is played all the way into Modern. And then our like low drops, though, are much worse than the other options you get to play. You get to play like Prowess creatures, but you don't get to play anything close to Lightning Bolt. You literally play Shock. Your black creatures are at least Savannah Lions that can come back. And even the like ramp into 3-drop is so bad because it's just so much worse than all this other stuff now. It's crazy.
Yeah. Interesting. I will say that I like enjoyed my time playing Pioneer this week, but just seeing the sort of metagame laid out like this. And again, this report is taken only from the challenges and preliminaries and PTQs. So league results were not accounted for in this metagame analysis. So the winner's metagame just does not have creature decks in it. But that being said, the format is still, I think, enjoyable as long as you understand that that's what you're in for, is a lot of these impressive decks that have strong engines, as David says. It's still a cool format, even though no one's paying attention right now.
I would say in the last like 5 or 6 leagues, so over the last 2 weekends, I've basically only played these 8 decks over and over again as well. So if you don't like playing the same decks over and over again, that's another thing.
Yeah, you and like 200 of your colleagues can play in the Pioneer leagues at any given time.
It's like, oh, Urien. So it's, am I playing Niv-Mizzet or Jeskai or Esper? Whatever it is, it's going to be a pile of removal and like 4 cards that if they resolve, I can't win. So
All right. Well, we'll leave it there for now. We can check in on the health of Pioneer during our flashback segment as we talk about some of the Magmatic Channeler Pioneer decks that we played. We also played some in Modern. We'll have all that for you after the break.
All right, welcome back. So our card from last week was Magmatic Channeler. Just a quick reminder, this is one in a red for a 1/3 human wizard. And as long as there are four or more instant and or sorcery cards in your graveyard, Magmatic Channeler gets +3/+1. So it becomes a 4/4. It has an ability, tap, discard a card, exile the top two cards of your library, then choose one of them. You may play that card this turn. So, Dan, this is a card you're pretty skeptical of. You thought it was, you know, maybe a little bit worse than Arcanist, or maybe very similar to Arcanist, a card we've been wanting to play, but always sort of discouraging results with. And so we had seen M. Hayashi have a bunch of different success with a bunch of different builds of his sort of alternative prowess list, many of which contain Magmatic Channeler. So as a kind of first run with this card, you took one of those lists through a league.
Yeah, so I expected that this deck would just give me a sense of, or how good is the 4-4 mode, or it would at least answer the question for me of like, how often do I just want to attack for four, or am I looking to actually tap this? Like, is the versatility going to matter? Because, you know, this is a red deck. It's four Swift Spear, four Soulscar Mage, Seasoned Pyromancer, Bonecrusher Giant, and then a big pile of burn spells. So Magmatic Channeler is just like, yeah, I'm probably going to be just trying to get them dead before they run away with the game. When I took this into the leagues, I went 3-2. Unfortunately, I just like almost never drew the Channeler. I think I drew it two games, and once it just like died to Bolt, and the other game it was not relevant. So I didn't get a great sense for like how the card specifically performed, although I did note that M. Hayashi has sort of moved away from it in their more recent builds. The deck as a whole was like really surprising to play with. Like I think of red decks as having a lot of reach, and this deck did not feel like it had reach. It felt like I could do like small chip amounts of burn, but it's not playing Lava Spike, right? It's playing Lava Dart, it's playing Fire Bolt, it's playing Flame Slash. So we're not talking about dealing chunks of 3 damage to their face. We're talking about dealing, you know, 2 damage either to them or to a creature and then attacking with your guys. It grinds very well because Seasoned Pyromancer light up the stage. Some versions play Obosh out of the sideboard, Bonecrusher Giant. These give you tons of things to spend your mana on. There's also Shadow Skull Smashing, which I did cast, I think, twice for its spell mode. So this deck has like plenty of stuff to do, but it just plays out so differently from what I was expecting.
Yeah, if people are interested, M. Hayashi has posted a bunch of his leagues on YouTube. I think it's under Magic Matt. So you can see how some of these games play out. And it is kind of like how you described, Dan. They're not... He never gets these nut draws, right, where the opponent is dead on turn four if they don't have the right removal. It's really built to draw a lot of cards for a red deck, which is very strange.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, the Channeler could also feed that plan, but I never really felt like I was on the verge of running out of stuff to do. There was always something to do, whether that's even just like, you know, exile a Seasoned Pyromancer for 5 mana and get 2 guys. But maybe that's all I need. Maybe I'm just like one Firebolt flashback away. I do have to give a shout out to Firebolts. I know I was skeptical of that. Last week, I was like, why wouldn't you just play Burst Lightning? But it turns out that Firebolt is perfect for this deck. I think I won a couple different games just flashing back the Bolt for exact ease.
So does this deck just like want to play the mono red control deck against creature decks as like the main matchup where you just kill every single thing they cast with a Firebolt against, you know, all these, you know, mono white taxes deck playing a bunch of 2/2s or humans where all their creatures are small to start?
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of what happens. And then, you know, when Bonecrusher Giant is the full-on 2-for-1, and then Light Up the Stage is a 2-for-1, and Firebolt's a 2-for-1, Seasoned Pyromancer can often be a 3-for-1 or more. It is just crazy. It just, it never runs out, like Dan says, it never runs out of things to do, but each of the things it's doing are like reasonably powerful. I mean, they're all trading for a card often.
Yeah, one of the storylines from the season finals on Arena this weekend was that, okay, Omnath was like 70% of the standard metagame, you know, there was only 32 players. Well, 31 of those players, so like 90-some percent of the decks, were playing Bonecrusher Giant. And a lot of players who were participating or just observing the standard format point out that this card really suppresses aggro. Like, it's really hard to play creature decks against Bonecrusher Giant. Now, here, this is a deck that is also looking to attack and get in there with the Bonecrusher Giants. But it's just like, yeah, it's a surprising card. It's like a perfect mid-range card. And same with Seasoned Pyromancer, perfect mid-range card. So you got like a mix of that with like the low end red stuff.
Yeah, for people my age, you should be thinking of Bone Crusher Giant as a Flame Tongue Kabu that you can actually pay in installments, and the final creature is actually much better against control. A lot of times, like using it to finish off a Teferi and then play it, it just feels so good. And then to get rid of it, they have to lose 2 life no matter what.
Yeah. So my takeaway from this list was that it's an interesting style of red deck. I don't think you can learn that much about the Channeler from it. I didn't draw it as often as I would like to, but I also just played enough games to just feel like the Channeler is not an important part of the plan. So this is not really a Channeler deck per se. So I just was satisfied with that and moved on.
Fair enough. So Damon, you played a Mardu list that was really looking to get some advantage out of the graveyard. Do you want to kind of talk about your list? So this is a Mardu Channeler with just a variety of cards that pay you off for being discarded.
Yeah, so David sent me a nice Mardu Channeler list, which basically is built around the cards Silver Smoke Ghoul and Smiting Helix, Lightning Helix, and Kaya's Guile as ways to gain life. And so the question is, well, how do we get Silver Smoke Ghoul in the graveyard? And what cards benefit from casting a lot of spells? And that's, well, Magmatic Channeler in a nutshell. This card is happy to discard a Silver Smoke Ghoul and find a Lightning Helix and cast it. And that's actually all of a sudden, you know, pretty good that you add a lot of power to the board and build towards a 4-4 Channeler. So alongside this, there's a lot of Seasoned Pyromancers is a mainstay card of this deck. Some Fatal Pushes, a bunch of discard spells, a couple Lilianas, a single Sorin I was trying out along with Two Knight of the Ebon Legion. We shouldn't do that, but lesson learned. And there was a Kroxa and 21 lands plus an Aghanim's Awakening. So took into the queues and I started off with 2 losses against Uro Omnath and Red Prowess. The loss against Prowess was a tough one. I was on the draw in game 3. And I was like, I can shock down to 10 life because I had literally Lightning Helix and Kai's Guile in hand with the Smiting Helix in the graveyard. And my opponent off of like 4 lands goes like Land, Reveler, Bolt, Lightning Spikes, Lava Spike, Gutshot from 10 life. And so I died. And maybe if I had like fetched a little bit differently, I could have survived. But from there, I rattled off 3 wins against Blue Moon, Green-White Heliod, and Green-Black Infect. And this deck just really likes to kill small creatures all day long. So if that's a good thing in your meta, Mardu Channeler is a really good spot to be. And I had a single Blood Moon on the sideboard. And one thing I've noticing from these challenges and leagues is that because of Cleansing Wildfire, people aren't, there's not a lot of Tron. In that sense, you don't need Blood Moon. But on the other hand, the like Omnath decks are like, well, we have some basics. We can withstand the Cleansing Wildfire stuff, but they don't have that many basics. They don't fetch them that aggressively. And so if you land a Blood Moon, like you can kind of lock them out, or at least they can never cast an Uro again.
That's really interesting. So one of my hopes for Magmatic Channeler, and specifically this Mardu shell, was that if you think back to like 2 years ago when Mardu Pyromancer was like one of the top decks in Modern, sometimes they would play like 1 or sometimes 2 Blood Moons main deck. Now, this is a Faithless Looting format at the time, so like it wasn't that bad to draw it in a bad spot because you were going to filter it away. You always had the option to discard it if you didn't need the Blood Moon. Do you think that Magmatic Channeler could do something similar where, like, yeah, maybe even move extra Blood Moons into the main deck even because you might have opportunities to discard them if you don't need it?
Yeah, I could be inclined to have a 1 Blood Moon main, 1 Blood Moon side, maybe even more. We're seeing Blood Moon in some of the other challenge decks, so I think people are understanding that this card is positioned to attack the meta pretty well right now. And the Channeler, you know, it just like in Legacy, every blue card pitches to Force. Apparently in a Channeler deck, everything pitches to Channeler. But yeah, I will say that the Silver Smoke Ghouls came back sometimes, which is, you know, just like we wrote it up, of course, it sounds simple, but it takes a lot to actually make that happen. Sometimes I would come back and then just not actually do that much. But, you know, it gives you some grinding potential against various decks where they have to answer your graveyard. On the other hand, if they do answer your graveyard, a lot of the deck gets a little bit kind of neutralized. There's just a lot of graveyard synergies going on here. But the Channeler itself plays an interesting role where, for example, if you have 1 card in hand plus a Seasoned Pyromancer, you can kind of tuck the card with the Channeler, play the Pyromancer, draw 2, and then figure out what you're doing with the Channeler card, which is sometimes I did it and I was like, ah, this is awesome. I feel so clever. Sometimes I would do it and like the Channeler hit would be 2 spells that cost 3 mana. I'd be like, well, if I do this and I can't play the Pyromancer, blah, blah, blah. And things would go a little bit wrong. Same story with Liliana of the Veil.
Did you find that you were just like trying to tap the Channeler most of the time? Or at what point were you looking to attack with it.
Yeah, a good chunk of the time the channeler would just die to a push or a bolt, but sometimes it would survive, and I would almost always be looting with it to start. Attacking as a 1-3 is just not worth it. Some games it would get to 4-4, and then actually would still be, you actually at that point maybe have bigger creatures in your arsenal. Like, you know, if you have a bunch of Silver Smoke Ghouls ready to go in the red zone, maybe you're better off using the channeler to run interference. Like what, like a Croaks, the 4-4s are fine, but frequently at that point in the game, the channeler's already done its job. Croaks was really good, by the way, in this list, which is weird.
So I think there's a lot of ways to build a Mardu deck. The core probably all starts with your Thought Seizes and your Inquisitions, let's say 6 or 7 copies of those. And then you're going to want Fatal Push, right? That's probably the big draw to playing this style of deck over something like, you know, what we just talked about, how like red-green Ponza can never kill a Death Shadow or a Scourge of the Skyclave, so they're just out. Whereas Fatal Push is the perfect card for against those, against taxes. So that's your core. Then you want some 2-drops because that's like your payoff for turn 1 Thought Seize, is that you can land something on turn 2 that starts to pull you ahead. And Channeler maybe can fill that role. So how would you rate it against other 2-drop options? And I'm thinking here, maybe specifically in the Rakdos colors, or even like splashing into white or green. There's a bunch of other cards you could consider. I mean, you have a Young Pyromancer here. We've seen Dark Confidant on this role. We've seen Tarmogoyfs. We've seen Renin 6, Stoneforge Mystic. What do you think?
Yeah, so what the Channeler does better than most of those other creatures is basically help you execute your game plan. So for Stoneforge Mystic, you play on turn 2, and all of a sudden, you know, you had plans for turn 3 with the rest of your deck, but you just want to put the Batter Skull into play. So in that sense, it's more similar to Dark Confidant, who also likes to just sort of draw you through your deck and find you the cards you need to execute a clean game plan. The question, I guess, compared to Dark Confidant is that a lot of these decks, you know, that self-damage is really bad, and dying to Lava Dart is also not a desirable attribute of a creature in this metagame. There are a lot of Lava Darts being cast these days, so that's kind of a similar ding against Young Pyromancer. And so Channeler dies to push, it dies to bolt, but sometimes it'll be a 4-4 and actually doesn't die to bolt. Dark Confidant just always dies to literally anything. There's also Spikefield Hazards running around. So in that sense, like, Channeler was a pretty good survivable creature. It's a little bit lower impact than Dark Confidant in a vacuum. You'd rather draw a card than kind of like loot a card, unless you're Dan, in which case that's, you know, the best thing ever. the times where you could discard a Smiting Helix or a Silver Smoke Ghoul, you know, it's nice. It is upside. I do have some doubts about the value of that upside compared to decks like Omnath Uro, which just go over the top of your cute little Silver Smoke Ghoul synergies, even when you do pull them off.
Fair enough. I mean, and that's, I guess, the third component of the deck is, okay, you have your one mana spells, your Disruption, then you have something on turn 2, and then you have some stronger stuff on 3. You probably want Seasoned Pyromancers. You probably want something, whether that's Liliana or Lurrus. You have a bunch of flex slots, and right now in this list that you're talking about, we've got this Silver Smoke package. That could easily be something else. Did you feel like there was some other build you were interested in to like round out the deck that would make it sort of show off the Channeler better or just be better positioned in the metagame?
Yeah, one card I was thinking would be good in this deck is Kaya Orzhov Usurper. There's a lot of 1-drops running around the format right now, and a lot of cards that are useful to exile from the graveyard. And so Kaya just seems to be pretty well positioned, and also diversifies the deck a little bit in the threat package. There's just certain matchups where Kaya is like absolutely incredible. Certain matchups where it's, you know, so-so. But the deck plays enough anti-creature, anti-discard, you can usually find a way to make Kaya work for you. And so maybe lean into the Planeswalkers, you know, Lilianas and Kayas together. I would trim the Knight of the Ebon Legions. The deck just actually is always busy with the mana, and so you don't have time to pump it. So yeah, I think you could maybe make it a little bit more controlling by removing some of the cheaper creatures and focusing more around Liliana's and Kaya and maybe another copy of Kroxa.
David, what do you think?
I think that Liliana is just a bad card right now. I don't think I've ever seen it come into play recently and been happy with it. But I like the idea of Kaya. That actually is very intriguing to me. It's another main deck way to attack Uro. It actually gets rid of, like, I think Damon is right, that there are just a ton of one-mana permanents around. Even these lists that normally wouldn't have any are probably playing Utopia Sprawl. So if she's going to be, you know, minus one-ing to basically Stone Rain and then stick around, that's pretty sweet. So I do like the addition of her.
Yeah. The thing I find challenging with these Mardu lists is you just kind of get the feeling, just think about what these colors do, that this deck just isn't going to ever have great matchups across the board. And so when is it right to make the deck be really good in the matchups it is good at, which is perhaps grinding against a deck like Humans or whatever? And when is it better to focus on shoring up perhaps your bad matchups? Or is it enough to rely on, you know, your thought seize and inquisitions to catch all?
And a lot of times, I mean, the sideboard is really important. So, you know, that is almost out of your hands. You can build a sideboard to beat certain decks. And if you don't play them, you know, you play a different deck and you look at all your sweet sideboard cards you don't get to bring in. And some matchups can't be fixed by sideboard cards at all. So I like the idea of a couple of Blood Moons main deck, actually.
Yeah, I wonder if you could figure out the right way to build this deck. And I think the Chandler would actually play a pretty good role. What it does for the deck is definitely non-trivial. You just need to figure out the exact right configuration for what we're seeing in Modern these days. And maybe the deck could be pretty decent.
Yeah, I think last week we touched on some other lists that had showed up, like Traverse Shadow packing a couple Chandlers. I don't even know if they're Traverse targets. Maybe they're just like a fine card to draw some of the time. This Grixis deck with Snapcasters and Bonecrusher Giants and Chandlers that I played against and was also showing up in 5-0s. So people are definitely like trying this out. There was even like a Mardu list with Chandler and Lingering Souls and that kind of stuff that was in the 5-0s as well. You know, if you like this kind of strategy, I think this is a card to explore more. I was wrong about it. It's better than I thought. All that said, I do think it's the kind of card where you don't like build around it, quote unquote. You have to like be okay if it just dies and does nothing. It can't be like integral to the plan.
Yeah, that's why you need the Lilianas, so you can discard your stupid Silver Smoke Ghouls. Season Pyromancer also is excellent.
Yeah, and I'm thinking maybe like you want to build a deck that has 8 2-drops. Maybe 10 2-drops instead of just like Chandler is my creature on 2. Maybe I want Chandler and something else and Tarmogoyf or and Stoneforge.
Yeah, one issue with cards like Stoneforge with Chandler is sometimes you channel, you know, and you hit a spell you need and a spell that you might want later. And the spell you might want later is going to go gone forever.
Yeah, yeah.
You can very easily channel away the equipment as well. if you like need your discard something to hit your third land drop, and then you're like, well, that Batterskull is gone forever.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, I can see that. Well, a good foray, I think, into the Mardu archetype. Should we dip over to Pioneer?
Yeah, so up next we have Pioneer, and it looks like David started off with a couple Grixis and Izzet adventures. So how did that go?
So the Grixis list always looks so inviting to me because you get to play the actual good cards of Pioneer, which are Thoughtseize and Fatal Push. And I really like the idea of when you're Goblin Dark Dwellers and you don't have a See the Truth, Dreadbore is just a no-moss, no-fuss way to kill a Planeswalker or a creature. So I'm always thinking, oh, adding black to these lists is, it's not free, but it just has to be better. And it just keeps being super frustrating. Part of it is the mana. Part of it is just the decks I played. I played Lotus Combo twice. And then I lost 2 super close matchups to Uriah and control lists. So I went 1-4, but the mana is a real issue. Just not being able to play out all your spells on time is really frustrating. You play a lot more coming to play tap lands. The pathways are awesome lands, but if you need to like Thoughtseize on 1, you are like committed to that being black for the rest of the game. And so your next land might have to come into play tapped. So yeah, I mean, all the individual cards always look good, but I just found myself, yeah, you still are lacking the closing speed. You know, I think at a certain point, even though, you know, you keep losing these games or it feels like you're getting unlucky, that just is the normal at a certain point. So I think I'm shelving the Grixis list, even though, like I said, when you play it, it's almost intoxicating. You're doing all these powerful things. Your hand always looks awesome. And you find yourself like just coming up short in game after game. So
looking at it, it looks like You're banking on 4 Thoughtseize, 4 Push, and then a pile of removal beyond that. Dreadbores, Spikefield Hazards is a 4 of, Bonecrusher Giants, 4 Fiery Tempers, and then you have the Goblin Deck Dwellers to like buy it all back. So was it a case of like these removal spells didn't have enough targets? Or was it more just like, you know, those were the problem, it was just that the mana was bad and the opposing decks were going over the top of you?
Well, a lot of problems that I have with Pioneer right now are that the format is very bifurcated. People are either playing a format deck where you need a ton of removal against them because blocking doesn't matter, or they are playing no creatures at all, basically, and so all your removal is dead. And you can't win one without a lot of removal, and you can't beat the other deck if you draw your removal. So, I mean, it's just a bad place for a mid-range deck right now in Pioneer. And so you see the decks I played, the one list that had creatures in it, I beat easily. And after board, you're probably a slight favorite against these Uriah lists, but they are often heavily favored in game 1. So, you know, if they're going up 1-0 and most of the time, I'm making up a number now, 75% of the time, and you're 58% after board, you're just going to lose really close matches, which is what I did to both your Iron Control lists. And then Lotus Combo is just going to get you.
Yeah, it's tricky with these the black cards where they just sometimes counter spells grind better against you know, come into play things or cards like the Great Henge off the top. There's just a variety of cards that the black cards are good at when they hit at the right time, but a little bit more fiddly otherwise.
So did you feel like this was a case of throw the entire concept out or tweak and move on to something better?
I mean, I've tweaked and tweaked the actual Grixis build a bunch. Played it a lot with Dreadhorde Arcanist, that we have a better tool now with Magmatic Chandler, and it still didn't quite get there. The problem is you're playing all these creatures. So this is sort of like when we were playing that 2-3 that taps to remove a counter to draw a card. You, in theory, have all this card advantage against control, but you're actually playing targets for their removal. So control decks aren't playing any. So you just lose all those points in game one.
Yeah, I think the solution to any Grixis list, in my opinion, is just add more Nicol Bolas's in any form. But the Ravager is like, well, if they kill it, they at least discard a card. Your Thassa's can help pave the way. If you ever flip it, you know, you're in a great spot. And you'll at least be happy during your league.
Yeah, I mean, to me, it's like the list that I played last week where I was struggling, every list I played today would crush all those decks. And so, you know, you just draw like the aggro half where you're playing all these people playing humans, and this list would have looked awesome. But you know, this week I just played Urien decks and Lotus combo. And so like playing four Fatal Push just feels terrible, but that card is a good card, right? It's just the matchups in Pioneer are just so bifurcated. It's really frustrating.
Yeah. Somehow Lotus combo existing is blight on the format, feels like.
Yeah. Dig Through Time had to stay legal. So what can you do?
It's like they almost have to ban Lotus Field itself. The matches I play against Lotus combo, it's not even the Dig Through Time that I'm worried about. It's like, yeah, they build up their mana, they eat up here through the abyss, and it's like, oh, okay. All right. But in any case, I'm looking at the next list you play, and it seems like a lot of the same cards from the Grixis list made it into the Izzet list. So it feels like there's something there at least.
Yeah, so this is kind of a modified version of the deck I played to a 3-2 last week, and I went 3-2 again. It's hard to take away any lessons because it just feels like very matchup dependent. If I'm playing a list where some of these cards matter, then the list actually feels awesome. I definitely did feel advantaged in all the sideboard games against blue-black control or Urien control lists. I outcarded Lotus Cobra Omnath very effortlessly with Kiora, which felt awesome. And like Hammer Time is just was a buy. And then of course I lost a Lotus combo as usual. The list I'm posting here has two Narsets to at least be another card against them that also could come in against control. But one of the things this deck had that the other deck didn't is the closing speed is much higher because you're playing Glorybringer and the mana is perfect. You're actually playing 27 mana sources because you're playing 4 Spikefield Hazard and 2 Glasspool Mimics. So you always have your colors all the time. You play mana out until 5 or 6, and then the Power of Magmatic Chandler and Jace kick in where you basically don't ever draw any lands again. And Glasspool Mimic, I even share a screenshot with you guys where we both extended all our resources. I had one Chandler in play and my hand was just 2 Glasspool Mimics. So what would normally be a flood situation is me just playing these super powerful 4/4s out. Yeah, this list actually felt sweet. One of my losses, it was just a straight up punt. I was talking through a play with a buddy of mine. I was chatting and we got distracted and made literally the only play that could lose the game. And then, you know, we lost a heartbreaker to Lotus combo, but everything else actually felt great. So when you're casting Goblin Dark Dwellers with Kiora in play to see the truth and you're just getting like 4 cards, oh man, it just feels so sweet.
So did that happen very often? I mean,
oh yeah, it happened all the time.
Okay.
Kiora is actually amazing in this deck. The league I played, I only played 2, and I just always wanted to draw it. It's awesome with Jace. It's awesome with like leaving mana up in post-board games against control. Against other mid-range lists, it just draws a ton of cards. Like, control decks are actually having to kill it instead of my Bone Crusher Giant or whatever. Like, you play your Kiora on 3, they play Teferi minus on your, you know, 2-mana threat. You shock with Bone Crusher Giant, play your Bone Crusher Giant, draw a card. And so their Teferi's gone and you're up a card already. And they have to decide what to do now. And like your next play is going to be a 5-mana threat and being able to leave mana up. Or, you know, if you have a Chandler, you can draw with it and still get to attack. It just does a bunch of stuff for the deck. And you have a ton of 4 mana plays. Plus Glasspool Mimic is like another hidden, a bunch of 4 power drops. So, you know, you have a Glorybringer in play. It draws you a card. It draws you a quote-unquote land, Glasspool Mimic. Well, next turn, you're doing 8. I mean, you've just done 12 to your opponent and drawn 2 cards and killed any creatures they have in play.
Yeah, this list looks sweet. I always wonder, is it better to just run four See the Truth, four Goblin Dark Dwellers in this sort of list and really kind of try to hit that every game in as consistent a way as possible? Or like, what is the right number? I see here you have three See the Truth, two Goblin Dark Dwellers.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't want to have too many five drops. I did want some number of Glory Bringers with Kiora, just as sort of a way. It's both a way to pressure Planeswalkers. It almost is a five mana kill a Planeswalker. Not always, unfortunately, with how some of these Planeswalkers are designed. And it is just, I just wanted a faster way to end the game. Like, I found my closing speed was too slow, and so Glorybringer is a card that just all of a sudden gets there. Goblin Dark Dwellers, unfortunately, doesn't have a lot of good removal targets. You know, doing three damage is okay, but it often won't kill Planeswalker. It doesn't kill Omnath, etc. So I didn't want too many of them because I didn't have that many great targets for them other than See the Truth specifically. And a lot of times, if you're really drawing well, you're not going to have a chance to play a See the Truth or get it in your graveyard. It's often like a late game play. So it's like what I would do often is play out my threats. If they had the Wrath, that'd be often a turn where I could, with Kiora, See the Truth and then still have enough mana to actually cast Goblin Dark Dwellers or even use See the Truth to find Goblin Dark Dwellers. And then you kind of reload it. You've added four power to the board and you have like five cards in your hand again.
Yeah, so maybe the 3-2 split is the right way to go for either both this variation or the kind of more control list that I have been playing over the last month or two to middling success.
I guess Glorybringer does kill Omnath if you need that to happen.
Oh, yeah, it did that all day long. It's just so sweet. They play out Omnath, you play your Glorybringer and kill it.
And it's not clear who's ahead.
Well,
oh, you're miles ahead if you ever do that, by the way. If you play Kiora on 3 and they play Omnath on 4, and you play Glorybringer and kill Omnath, you pretty much cannot lose that game. They can't even kill Glorybringer in their whole list. They aren't playing any removal. They don't have a way to get up to their like 8 mana spells. Like, they'll just play their 5 mana sorcery, play one extra land. Like, you just have free reign.
Yeah, I guess I'm thinking of the Omnath lines in Modern where the Hour of Promise happens right after.
Yeah, they can't win with just their lands. They have to actually like resolve 6 or 7 mana sorceries. I mean, Omnath is a cool card. That was actually my most fun match. It was super Battlecruiser magic. I think I ended that game with like 10 cards in my hand.
So what's your final verdict on this Is It build then?
This Is It build is super fun to play. I do think because it just has a generic closing speed and perfect mana, you just don't have any non-games. So I like it against any other like mid-range build. I think you are highly disadvantaged in game one. And so your sideboard really needs to favor your ability to play against combo and your iron lists. And you can look at the list posited when we talked about the most common pioneer list. Those are everywhere. The top 9 is basically all that. You're naturally just great against mono black because you're playing 4 Spikefield Hazard main. So I really only have like 4 or 5 cards against aggro in my sideboard, and everything else is sort of dedicated to the idea of being able to fight a Urion list in various constructions. And I'm adding the 2 Narsets to try to have more game against Lotus combo. But yeah, Chandler's awesome in this list. Chandler triggers Kiora in the late game. In the early game, it's awesome with Fiery Temper. I think actually Opt is a really key card. It seems strange, but like Opt helps you like cycle away the cards you don't need because, like I said, the matchups are so bifurcated. So like Wild Slash is basically like a non-draw against like every list that I played, you know, if you're playing your Ryan list or whatever. So like if it's filtering away that and drawing anything else, it's almost like a draw too. And it just helps you like hit the right number. Like my Magmatic Chandlers were 4 power so much more often in this list. So somehow like Opt was like a super crucial card. It's weird to say, but like every time I played it out, there was always like an Opt in my graveyard. And it's not a ton of like fixing or smoothing or whatever, but it's just enough to really matter. So I would recommend this list. It's a blast to play. You draw a ton of cards. You can even go over the top of some of these decks. They're supposed to go over the top of you. Like I said, I just outcarded Lotus Omnath twice, just very, very easily. And yeah, so just dodge Lotus combo, which you should try to do anyway, because that deck just sucks.
I second that notion. So I ended up playing a little bit of Pioneer. What I thought was going to be a little bit of Pioneer, I thought, I'll just do one league. And before I knew it, I was like, maybe I should do one more league. And I was like, oh, this deck is fun. I'll do one more. I ended up playing 4 leagues in a row with Pioneer Is It Phoenix list. It had a lot of the same tools that, David, you were using in your Is It list. But I got to say, I really, really liked the feel of how this list ended up playing. I'm going to give you guys sort of the abridged version of what I learned. I'm in the process of writing up like a full deck guide and primer, which should be up on faithisbrewing.com by the time this episode goes live. So you can read my thoughts in greater detail there if you're listening and just like, if you love Is It Phoenix. I am going to endorse this deck strongly because I had a great time with it. So the concept here, is it Phoenix and Pioneer is not like the modern deck, right? It's much more of a mid-range deck. So if you're thinking back to the reign of Phoenix and Modern, and you're traumatized by Thing of the Ice on turn two, followed by Faithless Looting, discard some birds, you know, bolt, Surgical Extraction, Mana Morphose, attack for 10 or 13 on turn three. This is not like that at all, right? It can't be that because the spells you have to play to return Arc Like a Phoenix, Opt is the only one that's shared with the modern card pool. Everything else is worse. Wild Slash, Lightning Axe, I added Spike Field Hazards because they looked impressive in David's lists. These are all defensive spells. Those are only really good if you are targeting creatures that the opponent spent time and resources to cast. You're not like burning them out with these cards. So you're really looking to create like a small tempo window where maybe like end step you burn their creature and then you can untap and do something to advance your own game plan. So that's where the two drops come in these Pioneer Is It Phoenix lists. And Magmatic Channeler was a card that seemed like, you know, maybe it could be like the perfect fit. Much like in the modern Mardu list that Damon was testing out, there's a ton of options. So you could play Young Pyromancer on two. You could play Thing in the Ice. That's Pioneer legal. I've played Sprite Dragon there before. You can even play Jace Fringe Prodigy if you hate yourself. And Channeler, I think, is actually like better than all of those cards because this is a kind of deck that, you know, you use are basically just trying to set up for the first three, maybe four turns. And then, you know, eventually you turn the corner around turn four, five, six, you really start to accelerate. It becomes a Treasure Cruise deck around turn four, five, and six. It's the only Treasure Cruise deck in Pioneer. And when you're playing Treasure Cruise, chaining one into the other, it's like, man, how is this card legal? This is so, so good. So Channeler just seemed to like fit perfectly into the two slot as just like the most medium thing you could do that leaves all your options open. And it makes Fiery Temper a good card. That was like the thing I didn't really understand at first. David, you promised me this would be the case and I just didn't believe it. But now that I've tried it, I believe it.
It's even better if you play three more Jace.
I have too much self-respect to play three Jace Prince Prodigy. So the list that I'll post is the one that I arrived at after my first league. My first league, I went 2-3 and I was like, man, you know, I feel like I punted this away. Like I lost to a couple of creature decks and I was like, I shouldn't be losing to creature decks. My build was just like a couple cards off. I was still playing Ashiok main. I was still playing Izzet Charm. I had too many Sulfur Falls. Those became a lot less reliable with the pathways. There just aren't that many basics in the mana base anymore. So I was like, you know what, like, this deserves one more league. So I tweaked it out and it just cleaned up the list a lot. I put Sprite Dragons into the main deck as a four of and moved the Thing in the Ice to the sideboard. And once I made those changes, it just felt so smooth. My second league, I went 4-1. I beat a couple of Black-White Auras decks. I beat Temur Reclamation. I beat the Urien Blink deck. And then I just narrowly, barely lost to Bant Reclamation. I didn't draw my Soul Guide Lantern in time to stop Uro. And I was like, you know what? You know, this felt like it should have been a 5-0. So I ran it back for league number three. And league number three, I got the 5-0. I just like crushed everyone. I got paired against a bunch of creature decks, burn, a couple Black-White Auras decks, a Humans deck, and a Spirits deck. So that was like a almost effortless 5-0 for league number three. And then I just decided maybe my results are skewed because I'm getting paired against aggro. So I played one last league and there I found the combo players. I got paired against two Lotus combos, Blue-White Control, Omnath stuff, and Jund's Citadel deck. That league ended up 3-2. So those are tougher matchups. I think I split the matches against Lotus Fields and I lost to Omnath again. But I beat the control deck. So I do feel like this strategy just sort of has the tools to keep up with most of the top decks. The only one that I can't quite crack is the Omnath matchup, just because when they get their engine going, they're just like going bigger and faster and they have unlimited mana. Whereas this Phoenix deck always has spells to cast, but it is gated on mana and it can't really go as big as those decks can.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely second your statement that this is a mid-range deck. When we were playing this with O3 Gal, that draws a card when you discard, that was my sense, is like getting a Phoenix back by turn three is basically impossible, but turn four or five is much more reasonable. And, you know, I think the faster draws are even more likely with Channeler. I mean, it's just a card that helps you find the right cards, that helps you cast Fiery Temper for one a lot of times. And it's another way to put Phoenix in the graveyard and another threat if you need it to be. Although I think if you start chaining your Treasure Cruises, maybe it has to spend some time as a 1-3 for a couple more turns until you can reduce.
That's what I thought would happen, but like you play a treasure cruise and you have all the spells you need to turn it back to 4/4 again.
Yeah, Dan, your list looks like a very clean Is It Phoenix list. Just very opinionated on what cards you want to play, what cards you don't with all the four ofs. But it sounds like you were doing, I mean, these results are great. Do you think that this list like should there be more Is It Phoenix in Pioneer? Because there currently isn't too much of it.
Yeah, I think that people should at least try it. I'm going to keep playing it until I start losing. It hasn't happened quite yet. I will say that in 20 matches, I think one Rest in Peace was cast and like two Soulguide Lanterns. Like no one was attacking my graveyard. Because if you look at the metagame snapshot, there isn't really a graveyard deck. So as long as like you have free reign to cruise and Phoenix and all that jazz, at least, you know, you can think about your deck in terms of like, how much can I do? They're not going to stop me. And then it's just like, do I have the right tools to fight back? And there it's, I'm not totally sure. Like, I feel like Sprite Dragon is weirdly the most important card for against control and combo, but it's like by far the worst card against anything with creatures. Like, it's like so off plan against a creature deck that you just discard them most of the time. You don't even bother to cast them because you're just hoping to win with Burn and Phoenix. Whereas against like anything with Teferi Time Raveler or anything just trying to like set up a Lotus Field kill, when you just need to like get them dead, Sprite Dragon is faster than Young Pyromancer. It's faster than Channeler. It's you need it to like pick off Teferis and do all that stuff.
And I mean, I know you're 150, you just played a bunch of aggro players, but I have found that to not be the case, that there are not a lot of aggro players out there. So maybe a card that's good against those troublesome matchups, and you know, maybe you're giving away a few percentage points in game one against these other decks, but they're a good matchup for you for other reasons, and you can board into a point where they're, you know, an even better matchup. But yeah, I mean, I'd kill to get the matchup spread that you're seeing here. It's like, oh man, Boros Burn and White Black Humans, like, oh please. My Fatal Pushes would have targets? Like, what kind of world is this?
Yeah.
Yeah, David, you had a really unfortunate run of Pioneer matchups, it looks like.
Yeah, the other problem with Lotus Combo, I hate to say it after they banned the card, is you haven't necessarily lost. Like, say what you want about the red enchantment, I really hate it, but at least I could very comfortably right-click, concede a game. But sometimes they don't have it. Sometimes you would get that one extra turn, and so you kind of just have to sit there F6 for a long time as they make a lot of game actions.
Oh, I didn't even think about that. I always just like snap conceded when they resolved the Peer into the Abyss, but maybe they didn't actually draw their... maybe I should have made them click it out. I don't know.
But anyway, it's still very encouraging that that it felt so smooth. And so Chandler, to you, was one of the key pieces maybe that it was missing, where it helps fill up your graveyard. It's another threat. It kind of does everything that you want it to do.
Yeah, and I think it's because this deck has to play different roles depending on what the opponent is presenting. And every other option, you know, even Thing in the Ice, it's like really bad against control. Sprite Dragon is really bad against aggro. Young Pyromancer is like, it's like your closest hedge, I think, is Young Pyromancer. But it's not like a fast card by any stretch. Whereas Channeler, like no matter what, if you're untapping with a Channeler, you feel like you're gonna do something proactive and good for the next few turns, as long as Channeler is in play. And often I was just like, yo, I need to hit land drops. And the Channeler gets me two looks for my next land. And it like adds mana for the Fiery Temper by reducing that to one. It adds mana by just like fueling the Treasure Cruise, like any discard outlet would. It was just like a perfect supporting player. And again, like I said, we can't like rely on having it in play. It's not that important. I did side it out against like the combo and control decks. But in terms of just like a good all-rounder for your main deck, this is the go-to card.
Nice.
All right, so I'll post my list and I'll post a link to the article because I have a lot more to say about it, but we got to move on. Any closing thoughts on Magmatic Channeler before we close the book on this card for the week?
So I guess I just have a high-level question. Do you guys feel pretty good about knowing when and how to channel?
Yeah, you know, in my second or third league with it, I finally got to a point where I'd be like, I felt like I knew what I was going to do each turn before the turn started. But yeah, there's some times where it's like, I got Crooked once, I had one land and like two Goblin Dark Dwellers in play, and my graveyard was just stacked with stuff I wanted to cast. So I was like, can I just like freely discard my land? And I just get three cracks at it the next turn? And I was like, yeah, I think the answer is yes. So I always kind of felt like I knew what to do. But the tough part is when they're at like nine or whatever, and you need to decide like if it's time to attack when you draw a blank. That's when I think the choice gets tough. Like, is putting them on a three-turn clock worth like turning your Spire Bluff Canal into possibly another threat?
It took me a couple tries of like failing to use the Channeler. There were a couple of matches where I thought, this is my first league, And I was like, man, I should try like to activate it on end step. Like I want to like maybe block, leave it as a 4/4 to block with. And then on end step, you know, I have a useless land. I'll try leading that away. Maybe I can hit a wild slash. And, like every time I did that, I just like whiffed. I was like, okay, I'm not going to do that anymore. Don't do that. It's just, it feels so bad. Also like the turns where I'm like, oh, I could really use a land drop here. So I'll tap the channeler, discard and get two looks for my land. If you whiff, it's like, well, I'm not casting those cards either. I just like discard a card for no reason. But I mean, that being said, like that's probably still on plan. I still won those games. It was probably for the best that it got me two looks closer to my next land. Hmm. What about you, Damon?
I think the card is super powerful in Pioneer. Modern has a bull problem. You know, I'm a little skeptical of it there. I think it still could have some applications. But on Pioneer, I just think it's like a super powerful card. I think it's better than Young Pyromancer. I think it's way better than Arcanist. And unless you're like in a straight aggro deck, I think it's kind of the only hope for like a red or red X mid-range list in Pioneer.
Yeah.
Yeah, the card seems good.
All right, so buy your playset while there's still a dollar before they go to $1.50. So we'll leave it there for Magmatic Channeler. We'll take a short break, and we will be back with our card of the week.
Welcome back. Our card for this week is Luminarch Aspirant, one in a white for a 1/1 human cleric. With, at the beginning of combat on your turn, put a +1/+1 counter on target creature you control. So the nice thing is that this is kind of like pseudo-haste, like Rabble Master. You play it and you get the counter immediately. If you're playing against this card, make sure you set a stop on your opponent's first main so that you can interact before the trigger goes on the stack as soon as they enter combat. So well, this card is very intriguing just because it doesn't really tell you what to do with it. Is this card meant to just kind of grow like an Ajani's Primate that doesn't need outside help and eventually become, you know, Tarmogoyf sized or eventually Scourge of the Skyclave sized? Or is it meant to kind of like combo off with +1/+1 counters for Ballistas, Hardened Scales, or Conclave Mentor type stuff? Or any other type of things, like any other fun things to do? So what does this take you?
So are you asking, is it a synergy card or just like a power card? Like it's a very large 2-drop basically?
Yeah, exactly.
Now that you mention it, is this the largest white 2-drop?
Well, again, I mean, Ajani's Primate can grow really big really fast if you have the right supporting structure. Archbond Ravager is also possibly the biggest white 2-drop in the right list.
There's also a 4/4 2-drop that requires you to put two cards from a graveyard under at the bottom of your library.
Oh, yeah. That Yotun Grunt, maybe that's coming back in call time.
Yeah, or they'll, well, these days they'll probably make it green and blue, so it'll be like one green and a blue for a 6/6 that exiles your opponent's library from the game and draws a card. Take one damage.
So I guess there are plenty of like white aggro creatures. So if we're thinking specifically like, oh, I want to build a deck that cares about having a large 2-drop, you do have to compare this head-to-head with cards like, you know, even Tarmogoyf. But maybe Thalia's Lieutenant, if you're doing a humans, like Lord type strategy, competes with Stoneforge Mystic. So it's kind of like, even if we like what the stats this is giving us, as like a card that will attack as a 3/3 on the next turn after it comes into play, there's still like stiff competition. So I am curious to see like whether this will clear the bar as just like a fine play on turn two, or whether it has to be supporting some kind of neat synergy plan. I've seen a little bit of both. This card has been showing up in a number of lists in both Pioneer and also in Modern. So that kind of gives me some hope that maybe there's something here. But that being said, I'm curious what you guys, or David, what you think you want to do with it.
Well, I think one of the things that's cool about it is if you put it in play and it doesn't die that turn and you can buff a 1-drop with it, now you kind of, if you're just trading a card for a card, if you're lightning bolting it after that happens, that's already great. So it's a 2-mana card that traded with a card and it had 1 power faux haste, or even better sometimes if it lets a creature attack through a card it wouldn't be able to attack through anyway, like a super exalted. And then that power stays around and they're encouraged to do so right away. So they almost have to kill it on their turn. They can't wait until your turn, likely, because they want to kill the aspirant, but they also are going to want to kill the creature that it's adding the +1/+1 counter to. So you're adding a large element of choice to your opponent. So yeah, I mean, I think of it as like, you know, a 2-mana 3/3, but one of those power has haste and it also threatens to grow every turn for the rest of the game.
So let's take a look at some deck lists and maybe we'll sort of think through how this will actually play out.
Okay, so the first list I have is what I'm calling Spooky Zoo Lightsaber. So spooky refers to the ghost, the Geist of St. Traff. So we had talked last week about some of these shells that were using Geist of St. Traff plus Maul of Skyclaves to sort of take it to the sky. This is kind of a similar plan that people were using way back when Geist was printed, and they were using 4-mana Elspeth to send it to the sky. But you can tutor with Maul, so you only have to play one because you're playing 4 Stoneforge Mystic. I wanted to kind of like increase the number of times I get my nut draw with Geist. So I'm playing 5 mana creatures, 4 Noble Hierarch, 1 Birds of Paradise. They should also help like the mana in our deck because we are like a full 4 color mana base. Luminarch Aspirant in this list is just a sort of on curve beater. Adding the +1/+1 counter to the Geist is sort of one of the goals here. When Geist gets big, even if it doesn't have the Maul or anything else on it, it just helps it attack through normal boards. And that kind of threat is what we're looking for. I also have kind of a cheeky one Vaedroc Apex of Thunder. That's a card that both casts Tribal Flames from the graveyard or Lightning Helix or Lightning Bolt. It also can go onto Geist and take it to the sky. So if you like have a Tribal Flames in your graveyard, you cast Vaedroc on your Geist. Now you're attacking with your Geist for 7 and your Tribal Flames did 4 or 5. So we're talking about just like well over half of your opponent's life just sort of out of nowhere.
So in this list is basically taking the place of Tarmogoyf. Because I think that what I find interesting about Aspirant is that the ability benefits more the longer the game goes on. And so do you want to build this deck to sort of play a slower game or a faster game? And I guess this deck has a pretty clear answer. It wants to start ramping on the earth like the first turn, and then from there just put the pedal to the metal and end the game really as fast as possible.
Yeah, the other thing that I think is kind of interesting is if you're on the play and you play Wild Mikado and they play, you know, a tap Triome, Luminarch Aspirant actually can put Wild Mikado out of bolt range right then on turn 2. So that's kind of your other like draw. Like if you don't draw your mana creature, Wild Mikado is like a way to lean more into aggro. I didn't like that the other list was kind of leaning into a mid-range package where you were casting your like your ramp spell with a cantrip but you didn't really have actual like counter spells. This is more like building off the sort of counter cat mentality from the early days of Modern that Brian Kibler and Raptor and Conley Woods were sort of propagating. And I just like the sort of synergy between the Tribal Flames aspect of it, plus the Geist and putting all that with the Stoneforge Mystic, Maul of Skyclaves. But just like the Wild Mikado is just another way to pressure their life total early. I think going into the mid and late game is really big ass for any deck that's playing cards like this when people are playing Omnath and Uro. So I just don't think you're interested in getting too deep into those kind of battles.
Tell me why I should not play One Chance for Glory in this list. I mean, Luminarch Aspirant, I mean, that's steady value. It's much better to time walk with a Planeswalker on the board, right?
Oh my gosh.
I guess so. I mean, if you're really leaning into like the Geist gets in for some beats and then you just take that one more turn.
That's another attack with the Geist. Hexproof Indestructible. Okay, this list, I love how like the Aspirant is actually faster than Tarmogoyf from a certain point of view, right? Like it comes down, it gives its first counter right away, where I think it could make the huge differences on that Geist line you're describing, David, where the difference between being able to attack safely with Geist and not being able to is like the difference of 6 or 7 damage in this case. So the more ways you have to incidentally buff it, there aren't that many cards that can distribute +1/+1 counters freely without also just like sucking in general. And Luminarch Aspirant holds its own when Geist is not in play. And it's like incidentally provides some Geist support. So I love that here. Whereas Tarmogoyf, you know, Zoo does not fill up the graveyard that well. This seems like an interesting home for it for sure, that where it could really shine as an aggro creature. Would love to cut the remands though. I don't think that the counter package does anything at this stage.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, why try to remand for a time walk when you can just cast actual time walk but on?
That's a fair point. I like it.
Okay, so one other Modern list I just want to ask you guys about. This is not ours, but this is one that has showed up in a 5-0 league and also in a challenge over the weekend. It took, I want to say, a top 16 finish. So it's a mono white. It's a Heliod deck. So it's 4 Aether Vial because everything else is a creature. Heliod Suncrowned, Ranger Captain of Eos, and 4 Skyclave Apparition. Those are 12 3 drops. 4 Ranger of Eos, sorry, 2 Ranger of Eos. For 4 drops, so it is kind of going a little bit big. So it's not really a weenie deck. The lower end of the curve is 4 Giver of Ruins, 4 Oriok Champion, 4 Luminarch Aspirants, 2 Thalia Guardian of Thraben, and then there's 4 Walking Ballistas and 1 Hangarback Walker. These are cards you can find with Ranger Captain of Eos. So it seems like this deck is just trying to do the Heliod Ballista Sun Gun combo, or whatever you want to call that, and actually just using these cheaper creatures in supporting roles. So Giver to protect everything, Oriok Champion to protect you and gain some free counters off Heliod, Luminarch Aspirant to provide that extra counter to boost the Ballista. Is that your read on this deck as well?
Yeah, one of the kind of hidden combos here is that Oriok Champion is functionally like a Geist of St. Traft against these like red blacklists. So against Skyclave, you know, it's a 1-1, and what happens a lot of times is you kind of stare at each other until they draw their Bonecrusher Giant or whatever, and then they don't let you protect with your Oriok Champion. And you never want to attack your Oriok Champion because you're only doing 1 damage, right, to trade for their 7 from their Scourge. Well, adding the 1-1 counter safely every turn to Oriok Champion, like even a couple counters before they finally kill your Luminarch Aspirant, is really good. Like once Champion gets enough life, all of a sudden on these shadow decks are already damaging themselves significantly. It's just a 2-turn clock or something. So you just turn it sideways a couple times and the game is over. So I really like that aspect as sort of the not main plan. Obviously they're trying to Walking Ballista combo kill you, but that's almost like a soft combo kill against red black.
Yeah, and this list has 8 turn 2 plays, which set you up for a turn 3 Heliod, turn 4 Walking Ballista win in the form of the Oriok Champion and Luminarch Aspirant.
Yeah, I think I would not play the 1 Hangarback Walker. I'm not sure I believe in that card. I think the 3rd Thalia has got to be better than that a reasonable percentage of the time, especially in a deck that is not even playing Path. But this looks like kind of a metagame deck. I think it's going to have very polarized matchups. We talk about that a lot with these mono-white lists. This is a list that looks like it's going to be awesome against Red-Black Scourge, and maybe struggle against some of the like Uro piles where the interaction it has isn't quite, they're not that afraid of Oriok Champion.
Yeah.
I'm kind of surprised there's no collected company here. I mean, it's all creatures.
The mono white mana base is quite nice. You have a lot of white pips in the deck. Certainly Cocoa Splash is doable.
I think the tension is always, if you're going to play Fork Walking Ballista, it's not a good hit for your Cocoa.
Yeah, and you have the Thalias. But yeah, I mean, I think this deck is a great answer to, well, what is one use of the Luminarch Aspirant? And that's, well, to speed up the Heliod Ballista combo.
And I do think that's one of the reasons why they sort of proactively banned Walking Ballista, is I think that deck was going to get a huge boost from the Luminarch Aspirant. I think that deck would have gone from very good to incredibly good, and maybe even format warpingly good in the absence of the other combo decks.
Yeah, that's a great call. So speaking of Pioneers, should we dip over and take a look at this Pioneer list you've drawn up for us, David?
Yeah, so this one really leads into the +1/+1 counter theme. So you had said you had kind of drawn up a white-green list, and you really didn't like the look of it. I don't know exactly what you didn't like the look of, but you were just like, man, these cards are just so weak. This list leans into the fact that we did get a white-green pathway, branch loft pathway, so our mana is a little bit better. And it just kind of tries to like get these really nice nut draws. So we have our 4 experiment 1, 4 stone pelt collector. And those cards combo incredibly well with Winding Constrictor or Conclave Mentor. They immediately turn them into 3/3s. And then your next turn can be something like a Stonecoil Serpent, Huatli's Raptor, and all of a sudden you just added like a million power to the board. So this is a Lurrus deck. There are no creatures here that cost more than 2, and you're just trying to get your like nut draw opening draw where you're getting your Winding Constrictor, Conclave Mentor, or your Hardened Scales, and you're combining it with any of these things that evolve. I have a 1 Knight of the Ebon Legion in here. That's another card that adds +1/+1 counters. Dromoka's Command is our removal of choice. That adds a +1/+1 counter. Avatar of the Resolute comes into play with the +1/+1 counter, so it does help evolve. So yeah, the deck is just sort of super explosive, and the price you pay is that your mana base is terrible.
Well, you've got the pathways.
It's better than it was, but...
Yeah, the cheaper the spells are, the worse the pathways get, because the more the focus is on the pips. And this deck has a very low curve.
Yeah.
So this will be an entrance in the synergy category, right? Where you're like, okay, this is a Hardened Scales deck, although you're actually getting most of that effect from the creatures, from Mentor and Constrictor, and Luminarch Aspirant being one of the cheapest, most effective ways to get a bunch of +1/+1 counters added. I saw like actually a similar take on Abzan counters, but this was from Baker Neenan, who's VTCLA, host of the 75-card pickup cast. This is maybe a week or two ago. He had 5-0'd with an Abzan Counters deck in Pioneer, but it wasn't a Lurrus deck. And it was playing all kinds of like weird cards from Zendikar Rising, Grackmaw, the Skyclave Ravager card, the Hydra that dies into another Hydra. There's even like Swarm Shambler, the 1/1 fungus beast that comes with a +1/+1 counter, and then it like spins off some insect tokens. I don't know. Like, do you think that Lurrus is worth it? Or I guess I should ask you, David, are there any of the cards that are being played in this VTCLA list that you actually are interested in? You know, Anafenza, Rishkar, Grackmaw, Collected Company?
Collected Company is a sweet card. That's the one card I'm kind of interested in. And I do think Anafenza, just having passive ability against the Oops All Spells list, is interesting. But yeah, like, Swarm Shambler is just a bad card. I just don't believe in that at all. You know, we talked about Grackmaw, you know, when it was spoiled, and I'm not a believer in that card. You know, Rishkar, Anafenza, those are two cards that I played in my sort of like Abzan aggro list that had a lot of these synergies that I'm talking about when we did our 7-6 Dinosaur Week. And so I'm not opposed to those. But what I learned from playing all this Pioneer is that you just want to be like all in on aggro or all in on control, because your opponent's just sitting on all these removal spells. So like playing your 3-mana Anafenza or whatever is just a card that dies to someone spending 1 mana or 2 mana. So I think I want to build my deck to maximize nut draws, because everyone's just sitting there and they're just excited they finally have like targets for their fatal pushes, basically.
Yeah, those creatures look bad to me too.
I mean, I do like Rishkar. I think that card is sweet. And like I said, Anafenza is a card I'm excited to play. And main decking Scavenging Ooze is reasonable. But like, I don't think Swarm Shambler is very good. And I don't think Grackmaw is very good. And like, I'm not that interested in Collected Company that much if we're only just getting 2/2 drops and we have to like up our land count to do so.
I saw Swarm Shambler also as a 2/2 in a 5/0 list from a player named Mogged. This is just a straight white green hardened scales aggro. So 4 hardened scales for Conclave Mentor and no splash for Winding Constrictor. A lot of the creatures, David, the ones you identified are just like the best you can do in green and white. So Whatley's Raptor is here as well. And I'm just like wondering about that card. Like, is that actually good? Is it 2/3 it proliferates when it comes into play?
Yeah, I think so. Like, if you just consider an opening that's like experiment 1 plus then turn 2 Winding Constrictor, and then turn 3 you play like another experiment 1 plus a Whatley's Raptor, and you stack your triggers, you end with like 14 power in play and you've already attacked for 10. And so, I mean, you look at like Jeskai Luka, they're relying on 3 damage sweepers. Well, you've just grown so many creatures out of the range of that, that like playing that spell on turn 3 for them loses the game, that you just kill them with your next attack.
Because I didn't really think about how much damage it actually adds with a mentor in play. That's pretty cool. So we got a couple different takes here then, right? But they're both sort of leaning aggressive. I would say this Pioneer list, David, is more in on counter synergy, whereas the Modern list was more just like, I would like to get them dead, and Aspirant furthers the plan. Were any of these lists that we've been kicking around like feel like the right direction, or the most promising one, the ones you want to try first?
I mean, I do think you need to think about the card being super aggressive, because the days where like adding a power a turn or even 2 power a turn over the course of like 3 or 4 turns, that just doesn't fly anymore. Like Planeswalkers plus to get more value than that for no mana. So, you know, the way Modern card design is, it's just so easy for 4 and 5 mana cards to outdistance. Even if you're adding 2 power turn for free, you're going to want to just end that game quickly. So I think you want to do it in such a way that when it comes down, you're putting a +1/+1 counter if you get to combat on a different creature. Is that Thraven Inspector the best 1 white drop in Pioneer? Is that Wild Nacatl? Is it something else? Is it Geist of St. Trath that you played on turn 2 with a ramp guy? Is it, you know, a snake that you're turning into a 4/5 and now it can't be killed by any red removal spell? That's the question. But because then it puts them in the bind. They can kill whatever creature you buffed, or maybe they won't kill your Thraven Inspector. And then you're just threatening to keep adding power the next turn. So now you're not having to flood the board into their wrath or whatever. You can just play one more creature and it's becoming threatening naturally.
Yeah, that all makes sense. I'm just like excited to like put these decks into the queues and just see what happens, because the early returns on Luminarch Aspirant have been really, really weird. I just gotta say that before we wrap up. You know, this mono white Heliod Ballista combo deck is fine, but some of these other 5-0s are really strange. Like there's a 5-0 list that's like a red white Leonin Arbiter Goblin Rabble Master boom bust deck that just like happens to have Aspirant in there as a 2-drop, just I guess to maybe the theory here is to disrupt them with these random taxing effects and then just like get them dead really fast with a Rabble Master or an Aspirant. I am stunned that list 5-0'd. That was from Rebus 8. And another list that was even weirder was like a Bant Cephalid Constable deck. Am I saying this right?
Yeah.
And even just like uttering these words, you know you're in for some nonsense. Cephalid Constable, one blue blue, Cephalid Wizard. It's a 1/1, so 3-mana 1/1. It better have some awesome ability. Well, it says that whenever a Cephalid Constable deals combat damage to a player, you get to return up to that many target permanents that player controls to their owner's hands. So if it connects for one, you get to bounce something of theirs. If it connects for multiple damage, say with Noble Hierarch Exalted trigger, or with some counters off Luminarch Aspirant, you can bounce like two or three lands with the one Constable. And that list somehow 5-0'd.
That's another creature that works very well with Maul of the Skyclaves. And I think when Aspiring Spike played a list on, he has like a Dono deck Thursday, someone sent him a list that had a bunch of Cephalid Constables in it, or they paid him to build a list around Cephalid Constable. He was using, it had like a couple of Geists and four Constables and the Maul of Skyclaves. I think playing that list, he was like, oh man, putting this Maul on the Geist felt great. I think he went 4-1 or something with it. It was surprising how good at the time Cephalid Constable was, because it's so great against decks that don't interact. So specifically, it's very good on turn two against Tron and Titan. You just put all these lands back in their hand and just reset everything that they're doing. And so they almost can't come back from a turn two Constable.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure if you ever deal two damage with Constable, you just win the game almost.
But I think as the format has developed and you see these Uro piles that are full of, they've added a bunch more removal or multiple Teferis. And then obviously Red Black Scourge is less than impressed by what Cephalid Constable is bringing to the schoolyard.
I mean, with the right sword on it, then they are going to be Wayward Guidebeasting their whole board back to their hand.
I mean, I'll just put Wayward Guidebeast into my own deck. You don't even have to cast a Constable. I'm just happy to balance my own hands. All right, well, bringing it back slightly to our task for the week. So we have a couple lists to try out, and maybe we'll tinker some more and come up with something new. Damon, you want to sign us out?
Yeah, so it's been a lot of fun channeling out there in the queues, but until next week, we will be, I guess, worshiping the stars and seeing where that takes us. So if anybody else wants to worship the stars with us, we'll see you in the queues on these various Luminarch Aspirant decks.
Take care, guys.
All right, take care.
That's a wrap on episode 76 of the Faithless Brewing Podcast. Thanks for hanging out with us. We hope you enjoyed the show. If you're looking for any of the deck lists that we discussed, they are at faithlessbrewing.com. There's a link in the episode description that will take you right to it. If you would like to support our content, you can do so by joining our Patreon page at patreon.com/faithlessbrewing, where signing up at any tier gets you access to a number of rewards. You get Discord access. You get access to our full show notes, the extended versions that we work off of as we record. At the higher tiers, you can get merch. You can even get early access if you want to hear the entire episode before anyone else does. And we have some sweet playmats and custom tokens as well. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at FaithlessMTG. And while you're fiddling with your podcast app, we'd love it if you could take a minute to give us 5 stars and leave us a friendly review. That's all for this week. I hope you're staying safe. Happy brewing, and we'll see you next time.